You're listening to TalkZone.com.
TalkZone.com.
Internet Talk Radio. Now more of the Wild About Pets radio show on TalkZone.com. Once again, here's Susan Frank.
Welcome back to the show, brought to you by Nutrisource, a trusted family-owned pet food manufacturer for over 40 years. We're talking today to Barbara J. King, author of Being with Animals, Why We Are Obsessed with the Furry, Scaled, Feathered Creatures Who Populate Our World. We are looking at photographs of some of the animals and the subjects we're looking at, or I mean we're talking about today. So if you'd like to see those, just click the purple Look While You Listen button you see either on the homepage of my Wild About Pets radio show here on TalkZone.com, or you can click the purple button that also is on the episode page that's listed under the date of April 9th. We are streaming live right now. Our phone lines are open. So if you'd like to call in and ask a question of Barbara King, then you can dial 888-463-6748. We were talking about how our interactions and a relationship with animals goes way back. Tell us a little bit about what you found of how far back this goes, and Barbara, and what kind of evidence have we found of that?
Okay, well, as I mentioned earlier, some of the earliest evidence involves hunting, which is, of course, a rather narrow way to think about animal-human relating because you're killing and eating something. We know that is about 400,000 years ago. There's good archaeological evidence for spears and other types of weapons showing that our human ancestors were hunting large animals like elephants and mammoths. What starts to really move me and get me much more interested is when we find the cave paintings of Western Europe and Africa. Now, all along in the human lineage, we've had development of technology, as I mentioned, and tools and some interesting social patterns, families and all of this. But not until right about 32,000 years ago do we have art. So this is totally new in our evolutionary history, and the very first thing that gets painted on the walls of these caves are animals. Now, you can see with this beautiful photograph that you have posted from Chauvet Cave in France that this is not some kind of childlike art. This is very beautiful art that people were able to closely render and do a study of what animals look like. So if you look at these four different horses' heads, they are very realistic, and they seem to indicate different moods of the animals.
Yes.
Now, this supports what I was saying before, that we learn to look, really look carefully with other animals. But there's even more, because in certain parts of Chauvet Cave, not frequently but occasionally, there are painted human-animal hybrid images. Now, to me, this means we're getting away from even just natural history, you know, closely looking at animals and rendering them, but thinking symbolically. I mean, what does it mean to paint a half buffalo, half woman on a cave, or at another cave at another site in France that many people have heard of called Lascaux, to draw an image of a man with a bird's head? You know, we don't know exactly what people were thinking, but clearly, this is not just eating animals. It's thinking with animals about people's place in the world.
And this hasn't changed, because we know today we use animal pictures and depictions and graphics throughout many areas of culture, in high art and even in advertising. And so to just kind of put a interesting little juxtaposition here, we have our cave art, and then we have the company Gecko's logo of a gecko. And you also relate in your book an interesting story, which I had not known about this little gecko. And, you know, we love commercials that have animals of all fashions in them. So it appears that once the company started using this gecko, sales just increased.
Yeah, and they kept, you know, refining his voice. At first, it was very British and clipped and very formal, and then they decided to make it a little more relaxed and American, and it's true that sales went up, and now there's all kinds of fun products you can buy, starring the gecko. And I think that generally this is an indicator of our wish to see animals in us and to project ourselves in animals. It's, you know, we animate animals, we give them our words, and it's a lot of fun. Sometimes I have to say it worries me because, you know, we do want to try and see the animals in the world as they really are with some kind of dignity. It's clearly a continuum. I think the ad gecko is fine, but once you start, for example, putting chimpanzees in a Super Bowl commercial, then, you know, I'm no longer on board with that.
Right, and I had done a show with Steve Ross of Lincoln Park Zoo about why chimpanzees should not be pets, and we were discussing the idea of how the use of them in the media and of other animals and dressing them up as humans is often communicating a very incorrect perception of the animals. And so I agree with you that we do have to be careful. And it's interesting because you do mention this in the book that even though maybe we will take certain animals to our religious services or to church or to pray over, we are indifferent to others and it can be almost very callous. And of course we eat animals, but you know, that kind of makes sense for some of us who, you know, do choose to, be carnivores. But also, as you're saying, we love, love, love our animals, yet we sometimes exploit them. So it's such a strange dichotomy, isn't it?
Oh, it is. And someone asked me recently, you know, she called me and said, I'm so conflicted because I hear about all the people who feel so attuned to animals and yet there's so much abuse and neglect and, you know, should I become a vegetarian? I don't know what to think. And my response was, gosh, if you're not a little conflicted, you know, that's strange because it's a very difficult, complex topic. I am not a person who, you know, goes around saying that we all have to convert to vegetarianism. Mm-hmm. I think it's a great idea to eat less meat and to think a lot about where your sources of food come from. I'm, you know, worried, as most people are, about factory farming, those big corporate farms where the animals don't live in good condition.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's lots of ways we can help animals and that there's not one right way. And I think that's important because, you know, no one really wants to be preached at about, you know, you need to do this or you need to do that. Sometimes we can help animals by acts as simple as moving a turtle out of the road, you know, helping with spay-neuter initiatives in our communities, being aware of the pressures on apes and elephants when they live in the wild and they're eating at large scale for food, for corporate entities.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I want to think about it on a case-by-case basis, and I hope that we're all working for animals in our own way.
Let's talk about your experiences with some of the great apes. You met Kanzi, and we have a wonderful striking photograph of this bonobo. So let's talk a little bit about your meeting Kanzi, your experience with the bonobos and gorillas, and what this kind of meant for you.
Okay, well, first of all, I have to say this is the best photograph of Kanzi I've ever seen. This is wonderful.
It came from the Great Ape Trust. They have a page of free downloads. And
okay, well, I've been on there, but somehow I don't know, this is just striking me now, looking into his eyes. Kanzi is a type of great ape whose natural home is in Africa, specifically in the Democratic Republic of Congo. That's the only African country where this species lives. And bonobos are similar in many ways to the chimpanzees that we all know, studied famously by Jane Goodall. Well, Kanzi was born in 1980, and his mother was being worked with by some researchers who wanted to try to teach her some aspects of human language. So in other words, they surrounded her with symbols on a computer keyboard, and they were trying to teach her about how to communicate using these symbols. And her name was Matata. She's a very wonderful bonobo, but she just wasn't quite getting the lessons. At her side, as she was being taught, was this little bonobo named Kanzi. When he became 2.5 years, he astonished researchers by showing that he had absorbed all his mother's language lessons, even though the researchers hadn't been aiming at him. So in other words, what he's able to do is point to what are called lexigrams or symbols on a keyboard to communicate his requests and his thoughts. Additionally, he's able to understand a lot of human language. Now, I'd read all about this, but when I finally got to fly down to meet him at that time, he was living in Atlanta, and Dr. Sue Savage-Rumbaugh was kind enough to invite me to meet him. And I had brought a gift with me for Kanzi. I had known that he Joy's balls. He likes to play with them. So I bought a small ball and put it in the pocket of my blue jeans. Well, when I met him, I said for the very first moment in English, "Kanzi, I have a gift for you." Well, he ambled over to one of these keyboards where he has all these symbols. He looked at me again, you know, in the eye, and he said, "Egg?" question mark on his symbol board. Well, I was deflated because I had no egg, and clearly that's what he wanted. So I said, "No, Kanzi, I have a ball." And then he took the ball from me. He again looked at me. He went to the symbol board, and he pressed visitor chase. And then he invited me to play. That was his invitation. And, you know, I had never met this ape before. Mm-hmm. He didn't know my name. He called me visitor. He made some pretty smart utterances. You know, he was able to see that I had something round. He thought about it. He came up with an egg. He wanted to play. He invited me to play. And what he can do is much, much more sophisticated than that. But, you know, that was my experience, and it really blew me away. Mm-hmm. Talk about a conscious mind.
Yes.
There's one.
There is much more information, obviously, about Kanzi and the idea of the intelligence of the great apes. For now, suffice it to say, under my additional resources section, there's a link to the Great Ape Trust where you can read much more about Kanzi and some of the work that is being done and find out more about this organization. You also have had some experiences with gorillas, and that will lead me to a bit of a story that I had at Lincoln Park Zoo also. Mm-hmm. So photograph number 11, I just, the little baby gorilla is just so cute. I just had to include that
adorable
picture. And then you talk about some experience that you had about how gorillas seem to deal with death. And this family, there's two gorillas in photograph number 12. These are not dead gorillas, but they're sleeping.
No.
And I chose it because their position is so human-like, isn't it? And what I wanted to say is, clearly, Barbara, you were talking about gorillas, you know, Kanzi, who is doing remarkable things that is not what the average wild or captive gorilla is doing. But when I was working at Lincoln Park Zoo, I spent a lot of time in their new Regenstein Center for African Apes, because I was training the volunteers in that place. And so I got to observe people watching the families. There were two families of gorillas there. And of course, as you have done, when you watch humans observing the great apes, there's this captivation, but this almost kind of nervousness, because as they're watching some of these behaviors, I think it's like we are compelled, but we're also like, oh, I don't know what I think of this. And one of the examples was watching very familiar behavior. One of the females had a new baby, and she was just sitting, and the baby was kind of on her lap. And at one point, she picked up the baby's hand, and she pressed her lips as if she were kissing each of the five fingers.
Oh, what a beautiful thing.
Yes, on the hand, and the people around me gasped. And I heard people saying, but I do that with my child. And how the reactions were, wait a minute, I'm seeing a mirror here in a non-human animal, and what that can be like for people.
Yeah, the mirror is exactly the right word. I think when we go to a zoological park, you know, we have an open mind and we want to see what's there, but it can be very stunning and a little bit edgy in a not entirely comfortable way for some people to see not just that, you know, these are chattering monkeys or cute apes, but that there are reflections of the way that not only we act, but the way we think and we feel. And in fact, it's mother-infant behavior that I have studied for so long. And I've been very touched by the degree of tenderness and care in that example that you just mentioned. It's reflected of mothers for infants. And it's something that's clearly not instinctual. It's something that's learned, that the mothers get better at over time. And also, the gorilla families are units that are very cohesive, so they support each other. There may be conflicts, of course, but what I have noticed at the National Zoological Park, working with my students from William and Mary, is that if there's a conflict, let's say, between two gorillas, the family will often line up behind the weaker one and really jump in and support him, both physically and emotionally. So you really get the sense of a family unit at work. Some people welcome that, and others think, wow, you know, I'm not sure how I feel about being that close to an ape, but as anthropologists will tell you, we're very closely related to them.
You write, we can learn to love our lives, each other, with and from animals. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.